Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box going to get sent back to sender. And now you're going to have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will.
Adam Clayton Powell, for the first time, was defeated. Charles Rangel won in a very close election. Within a few years, Adam Clayton Powell would contract cancer and die.
If we must die, let us not die like hogs. End in some inglorious spot. What use is an extra year or two to the man who kills the time that God has given him?
Much of the story of Adam Clayton Powell is on display here in this anteroom of the Abyssinia Baptist Church. But there are many parts of the Adam Powell story that you cannot see hanging up on the walls, mainly the ironies in his life. Isn't it ironic that Adam Powell was such a loud voice that few people would listen to? Perhaps if his loud voice had been heeded on the question of police corruption, there may not have been a Knapp Commission. If his loud voice about government corruption had been heeded, there may not have been a Watergate. If his loud voice against hypocrisy on Capitol Hill had been heeded, perhaps Wayne Hayes and Tom Dodd and Earl Butts and Carl Albert and countless others might have not have been caught in such embarrassing situations. Adam Clayton Powell represents still another chapter in a long story of black militant fighters against oppression and injustice here in America. He wasn't perfect. He had his faults, but don't we all? The point is, he was a fighter. If he did play, he worked harder than he played. Most of all, he was a fighter.
As I know here, you're in trouble. Where it says about 30% are unemployed. That's why I'm working hard to get this surplus food here. Some of you say to me, well, I'm not like you. I'm not a congressman. I haven't got education. I haven't got work. But you're a human being. And you know what you've got? You've got in your hand the power to use your vote and to use even those few cents you get from welfare to spend them only where you want to spend them. A young slave boy stood one day before the greatest ruler of his day. And God said to Moses, what's in your hand? And Moses said, Lord, only I've got a stick, that's all. He said, well, let me use what's in your hand. And God used that slave boy with a stick in his hand to divide the Red Seas, march through a wilderness, bring water out of rocks, manna from heaven, and bring his people to freedom land. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? George Washington Carver, who was so frail that he was traded for a broken-down horse as a slave boy. And George Washington Carver, sitting in the science laboratory at Tuskegee, told me, he said, Dr. Powell, he said, I just go out in the field each morning at 5 o'clock, and I let God guide me. And I bring back these little things and work them over my laboratory. And that man did more to revolutionize the agricultural science of peanuts and of cotton and sweet potato than any other human being in the field of agricultural science. What's in your hand? Just let God use you, that's all. What's in your hand? I've got a string in my hand, that's all, and I'm flying a kite. And way up in the heavens, lightning strikes it. And I, Benjamin Franklin, discover for the first time the possibilities of electricity with a string in my hand. What's in your hand? Little hunchback sitting in a Roman jail. I haven't got anything in my hand but an old quill pen, but God says, write what I tell you to write. Paul wrote, I have run my race with patience. I've finished my course. I've kept the faith. Henceforth, as laid up for you. What's in your hand, little boy? All I've got is a slingshot. And the enemies of my people are great and big and more numerous than we are. Well, little David, go down to the brook and pick out a few stones and come on back and close your eyes if you want to and pull back that slingshot and let it go. David killed the biggest enemy, the leader of the giants, against his people, and his people became free, just letting God guide a stone in his hand. And a few years passed, and David is a king. And God says, what's in your hand? He said, I've got a harp in my hand. He said, well, David, play on your harp. And he played, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Maketh me to lie down in green pastures. Leadeth me beside still waters. Yea, though I walk through the valley in the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? Man hanging on a cross? I've got two nails in my hand. Father, I stretch my hand to thee. No other help I know. If thou withdrawest thyself from me, whither shall I go? And that man, with two nails in his hand, spit history in hair, B.C. and A.D., and what's in your hand tonight, people of Cambridge? You've got God in your hand, and he'll let you win because he's on your side and one with God, always in the majority. So walk with him and talk with him and work with him and speak together and fight together. And with God's hand in your hand, the victory will be accomplished here sooner than you dreamed, sooner than you hoped, sooner than you prayed for, sooner than you imagined. Good night and God bless you.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. President Tipton, Mr. Vice President, Governor, Congressman Thomas, Senator Wiley and Congressman Miller, Mr. Webb, Mr. Bell, scientists, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate your president having made me an honorary visiting professor, and I will assure you that my first lecture will be very brief. I am delighted to be here. And I'm particularly delighted to be here on this occasion. We meet at a college noted for knowledge, in a city noted for progress, in a state noted for strength, and we stand in need of all three. For we meet in an hour of change and challenge, in a decade of hope and fear, in an age of both knowledge and ignorance. The greater our knowledge increases, the greater our ignorance unfolds. Despite the striking fact that most of the scientists that the world has ever known are alive and working today, despite the fact that this nation's own scientific manpower is doubling every 12 years in a rate of growth more than three times that of our population as a whole, despite that, the vast stretches of the unknown and the unanswered and the unfinished still far outstrip our collective comprehension. No man can fully grasp how far and how fast we have come. But condense, if you will, the 50,000 years of man's recorded history in a time span of but a half a century. Stated in these terms, we know very little about the first 40 years, except at the end of them, advanced man had learned to use the skins of animals to cover them. Then about 10 years ago, under this standard, man emerged from his caves to construct other kinds of shelter. Only 5 years ago, man learned to write and use a cart with wheels. Christianity began less than 2 years ago. The printing press came this year. And then, less than 2 months ago, during this whole 50-year span of human history, the steam engine provided a new source of power. Newton explored the meaning of gravity. Last month, electric lights and telephones and automobiles and airplanes became available. Only last week, did we develop penicillin and television and nuclear power. And now, if America's new spacecraft succeeds in reaching Venus, we will have literally reached the stars before midnight tonight. This is a breathtaking pace, and such a pace cannot help but create new ills as it dispels old, new ignorance, new problems, new dangers. Surely the opening vistas of space promise high costs and hardships as well as high reward. So it is not surprising that some would have us stay where we are a little longer to rest, to wait. But this city of Houston, this state of Texas, this country of the United States was not built by those who waited and rested and wished to look behind them. This country was conquered by those who move forward, and so will space. William Branford, speaking in 1630 of the founding of the Plymouth Bay Colony, said that all great and honorable actions are accompanied with great difficulties, and both must be enterprised and overcome with answerable courage. If this capital history of our progress teaches us anything, it is that man in his quest for knowledge and progress is determined and cannot be deterred. The exploration of space will go ahead, whether we join in it or not. And it is one of the great adventures of all time. And no nation which expects to be the leader of other nations can expect to stay behind in this race for space. Those who came before us made certain that this country rode the first waves of the Industrial Revolution, the first waves of modern invention, and the first wave of nuclear power. And this generation does not intend to founder in the backwash of the coming age of space. We mean to be a part of it. We mean to lead it. For the eyes of the world now look into space, to the moon and to the planets beyond. And we have vowed that we shall not see it governed by a hostile flag of conquest, but by a banner of freedom and peace. We have vowed that we shall not see space filled with weapons of mass destruction, but with instruments of knowledge and understanding. Yet the vows of this nation can only be fulfilled if we in this nation are first, and therefore we intend to be first. In short, our leadership in science and industry, our hopes for peace and security, our obligations to ourselves as well as others, all require us to make this effort, to solve these mysteries, to solve them for the good of all men, and to become the world's leading space-faring nation. We set sail on this new sea because there is new knowledge to be gained and new rights to be won, and they must be won and used for the progress of all people. For space science, like nuclear science and all technology, has no conscience of its own. Whether it will become a force for good or ill depends on man. And only if the United States occupies a position of preeminence can we help decide whether this new ocean will be a sea of peace or a new terrifying theater of war. I do not say that we should or will go unprotected against the hostile misuse of space any more than we go unprotected against the hostile use of land or sea. But I do say that space can be explored and mastered without feeding the fires of war, without repeating the mistakes that man has made in extending his writ around this globe of ours. There is no strife, no prejudice, no national conflict in outer space as yet. Its hazards are hostile to us all. Its conquest deserves the best of all mankind, and its opportunity for peaceful cooperation may never come again. But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills, because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too. It is for these reasons that I regard the decision last year to shift our efforts in space from low to high gear as among the most important decisions that will be made during my incumbency in the office of the presidency. In the last 24 hours, we have seen facilities now being created for the greatest and most complex exploration in man's history. We have felt the ground shake and the air shattered by the testing of a Saturn C-1 booster rocket, many times as powerful as the Atlas which launched John Glenn, generating power equivalent to 10,000 automobiles with their accelerator on the floor. We have seen the site where five F-1 rocket engines, each one as powerful as all eight engines of the Saturn combined, will be clustered together to make the advanced Saturn missile, assembled in a new building to be built at Cape Canaveral, as tall as a 48-story structure, as wide as a city block, and as long as two lengths of this field. Within these last 19 months, at least 45 satellites have circled the Earth. Some 40 of them were made in the United States of America, and they were far more sophisticated and supplied far more knowledge to the people of the world than those of the Soviet Union. The Mariner spacecraft now on its way to Venus is the most intricate instrument in the history of space science. The accuracy of that shot is comparable to firing a missile from Cape Canaveral and dropping it in this stadium between the 40-yard lines. Transit satellites are helping our ships at sea to steer a safer course. Tyrus satellites have given us unprecedented warnings of hurricanes and storms, and will do the same for forest fires and icebergs. We have had our failures, but so have others, even if they do not admit them, and they may be less public. To be sure, we are behind, and will be behind for some time in manned flight. But we do not intend to stay behind, and in this decade, we shall make up and move ahead. The growth of our science and education will be enriched by new knowledge of our universe and environment, by new techniques of learning and mapping and observation, by new tools and computers for industry, medicine, and the home, as well as the school. Technical institutions such as Rice will reap the harvest of these gains. And finally, the space effort itself, while still in its infancy, has already created a great number of new companies and tens of thousands of new jobs. Space and related industries are generating new demands in investment and skilled personnel, and this city and this state and this region will share greatly in this growth. What was once the furthest outpost on the old frontier of the West will be the furthest outpost on the new frontier of science and space. Houston, your city of Houston, with its manned spacecraft center, will become the heart of a large scientific and engineering community. During the next 5 years, the National Aeronautic and Space Administration expects to double the number of scientists and engineers in this area, to increase its outlays for salaries and expenses to $60 million a year, to invest some $200 million in plant and laboratory facilities, and to direct or contract for new space efforts over $1 billion from this center in this city. To be sure, all this costs us all a good deal of money. This year's space budget is three times what it was in January 1961, and it is greater than the space budget of the previous 8 years combined. That budget now stands at $5.4 billion a year, a staggering sum, though somewhat less than we pay for cigarettes and cigars every year. Space expenditures. Space expenditures will soon rise some more, from 40 cents per person per week to more than 50 cents a week for every man, woman, and child in the United States. For we have given this program a high national priority, even though I realize that this is, in some measure, an act of faith and vision. For we do not now know what benefits await us. But if I were to say, my fellow citizens, that we shall send to the moon, 240,000 miles away from the control station in Houston, a giant rocket more than 300 feet tall, the length of this football field, made of new metal alloys, some of which have not yet been invented, capable of standing heat and stresses, several times more than have ever been experienced, fitted together with a precision better than the finest watch, carrying all the equipment needed for propulsion, guidance, control, communications, food, and survival, on an untried mission to an unknown celestial body, and then return it safely to Earth, re-entering the atmosphere at speeds of over 25,000 miles per hour, causing heat about half that on the temperature of the sun, almost as hot as it is here today, and do all this, and do all this, and do it right, and do it first, before this decade is out, then we must be bold. I'm the one who's doing all the work, so we just want you to stay cool for a minute. However, I think we're going to do it. And I think that we must pay what needs to be paid. I don't think we ought to waste any money, but I think we ought to do the job. And this will be done in the decade of the 60s. It may be done while some of you are still here at school at this college and university. It will be done during the terms of office of some of the people who sit here on this platform. But it will be done. And it will be done before the end of this decade. And I am delighted that this university is playing a part in putting a man on the moon as part of a great national effort of the United States of America. Many years ago, the great British explorer George Mallory, who was to die on Mount Everest, was asked why did he want to climb it. He said, because it is there. Well, space is there, and we're going to climb it. And the moon and the planets are there, and new hopes for knowledge and peace are there. And therefore, as we set sail, we ask God's blessing on the most hazardous and dangerous and greatest adventure on which man has ever embarked. Thank you.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
I'd like to tell you about the strangest secret in the world. Not long ago, Albert Schweitzer, the great doctor and Nobel Prize winner, was being interviewed in London, and a reporter asked him, Doctor, what's wrong with men today? The great doctor was silent a moment, and then he said, men simply don't think. And it's about this that I want to talk with you. We live today in a golden age. This is an era that man has looked forward, dreamed of, and worked toward for thousands of years. But since it's here, we pretty well take it for granted. We in America are particularly fortunate to live in the richest land that ever existed on the face of the earth, a land of abundant opportunity for everyone. But do you know what happens? Let's take 100 men who start even at the age of 25. Do you have any idea what will happen to those men by the time they're 65? These 100 men who all start even at the age of 25 believe they're going to be successful. If you asked any one of these men if he wanted to be a success, he'd tell you that he did. And you'd notice that he was eager toward life, that there was a certain sparkle to his eye, an erectness to his carriage, and life seemed like a pretty interesting adventure to him. But by the time they're 65, one will be rich, four will be financially independent, five will still be working, 54 will be broke. Now think a moment. Out of the 100, only five make the grade. Why do so many fail? What has happened to the sparkle that was there when they were 25? What's become of the dreams, the hopes, the plans? And why is there such a large disparity between what these men intended to do and what they actually accomplished? When we say about 5% achieve success, we have to define success. And here's the definition. Success is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. If a man is working toward a predetermined goal and knows where he's going, that man is a success. If he's not doing that, he's a failure. Success is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. Rollo May, the distinguished psychiatrist, wrote a wonderful book called Man's Search for Himself. And in this book, he says, the opposite of courage in our society is not cowardice, it is conformity. And there you have the trouble today. It's conformity. People acting like everyone else, without knowing why, without knowing where they're going. Now think of it. In America right now, there are over 14 million people 65 years of age and over. And about 13 million of these 14 million are broke. They're dependent on someone else for life's necessities. Now we learn to read by the time we're 7. We learn to make a living by the time we're 25. Usually by that time, we're not only making a living, we're supporting a family. And yet by the time we're 65, we haven't learned how to become financially independent in the richest land that has ever been known. Why? We conform. And the trouble is that we're acting like the wrong percentage group, the 95% who don't succeed. Now, why do these people conform? Well, they don't know, really. These people believe that their lives are shaped by circumstances, by things that happen to them, by exterior forces. They're outer-directed people. A survey was made one time that covered a lot of men, working men, and these men were asked this question. Why do you work? Why do you get up in the morning? 19 out of 20 had no idea. If you ask them, they'll say, everyone goes to work in the morning. And that's the reason they do it, because everyone else is doing it. Now let's get back to our definition of success. Who succeeds? The only man who succeeds is the man who is progressively realizing a worthy ideal. He's the man who says, I'm going to become this, and then begins to work toward that goal. I'll tell you who the successful people are. A success is the schoolteacher who's teaching school because that's what she wanted to do. The success is the woman who's a wife and mother because she wanted to become a wife and mother and is doing a good job of it. The success is the man who runs the corner gas station because that's what he wanted to do. The success is the successful salesman who wants to become a top-notch salesman and grow and build with his organization. A success is anyone who is doing deliberately a predetermined job because that's what he decided to do deliberately. But only 1 out of 20 does that. That's why today there isn't really any competition, unless we make it for ourselves. Instead of competing, all we have to do is create. Now, for 20 years, I looked for the key which would determine what would happen to a human being. Was there a key I wanted to know which would make the future a promise that we could foretell to a large extent? Was there a key that would guarantee a person's becoming successful if he only knew about it and knew how to use it? Well, there is such a key, and I've found it. Have you ever wondered why so many men work so hard and honestly without ever achieving anything in particular, and others don't seem to work hard and yet seem to get everything? They have the magic touch. You've heard them say that about someone. Everything he touches turns to gold. And have you ever noticed that a man who becomes successful tends to continue to become successful, and on the other hand, have you noticed how a man who is a failure tends to continue to fail? It's because of goals. Some of us have them, some don't. People with goals succeed because they know where they're going. Now think of a ship leaving a harbor, and think of it with the complete voyage mapped out and planned. The captain and crew know exactly where it's going and how long it will take. It has a definite goal. 9,999 times out of 10,000, it will get to where it started out to get. Now let's take another ship, just like the first, only let's not put a crew on it, or a captain at the helm. Let's give it no aiming point, no goal, no destination. We just start the engines and let it go. I think you'll agree with me that if it gets out of the harbor at all, it will either sink or wind up on some deserted beach, a derelict. It can't go any place because it has no destination and no guidance. It's the same with a human being. Take the salesman, for example. There is no other person in the world today with the future of a good salesman. Selling is the world's highest paid profession, if we're good at it and if we know where we're going. Every company needs top-notch salesmen. And they reward those men. The sky is the limit for them. But how many can you find? Someone once said, the human race is fixed, not to prevent the strong from winning, but to prevent the weak from losing. The American economy today can be likened to a convoy in time of war. The entire economy is slowed down to protect its weakest link, just as the convoy had to go at the speed that would permit its slowest vessel to remain in formation. That's why it's so easy to make a living today. It takes no particular brains or talent to make a living and support a family today. So we have a plateau of so-called security, if that's what a person's looking for. But we do have to decide how high above this plateau we want to aim for. Now let's get back to the strangest secret in the world, the story that I wanted to tell you today. Why do men with goals succeed in life and men without them fail? Well, let me tell you something which, if you really understand it, will alter your life immediately. If you understand completely what I'm going to tell you from this moment on, your life will never be the same again. You'll suddenly find that good luck just seems to be attracted to you. The things you want just seem to fall in line. And from now on, you won't have the problems, the worries, the gnawing lump of anxiety that perhaps you've experienced before. Doubt, fear, well, they'll be things of the past. Here's the key to success. And the key to failure. We become what we think about. Now let me say that again. We become what we think about. Throughout all history, the great wise men and teachers, philosophers and prophets have disagreed with one another on many different things. It is only on this one point that they are in complete and unanimous agreement. Listen to what Marcus Aurelius, the great Roman emperor, said. He said, "A man's life is what his thoughts make of it." Disraeli said this, "Everything comes if a man will only wait. I have brought myself by long meditation to the conviction that a human being with a settled purpose must accomplish it, and that nothing can resist a will that will stake even existence for its fulfillment." Ralph Waldo Emerson said this, "A man is what he thinks about all day long." William James said, "The greatest discovery of my generation is that human beings can alter their lives by altering their attitudes of mind." And he also said, "We need only in cold blood act as if the thing in question were real, and it will become infallibly real by growing into such a connection with our life that it will become real. It will become so knit with habit and emotion that our interests in it will be those which characterize belief." He also said this, "If you only care enough for a result, you will almost certainly attain it. If you wish to be rich, you will be rich. If you wish to be learned, you will be learned. If you wish to be good, you will be good. Only you must then really wish these things, and wish them exclusively, and not wish at the same time 100 other incompatible things just as strongly." In the Bible you read, in Mark 9:23, "If thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believeth." Dr. Norman Vincent Peale said this, "This is one of the greatest laws in the universe. Fervently do I wish I had discovered it as a very young man. It dawned upon me much later in life, and I found it to be one of the greatest, if not my greatest discovery, outside of my relationship to God. And the great law, briefly and simply stated, is that if you think in negative terms, you'll get negative results. If you think in positive terms, you will achieve positive results. That is the simple fact, which is at the basis of an astonishing law of prosperity and success. In three words, believe and succeed." William Shakespeare put it this way, "Our doubts are traitors and make us lose the good we oft might win by fearing to attempt." George Bernard Shaw said, "People are always blaming their circumstances for what they are. I don't believe in circumstances. The people who get on in this world are the people who get up and look for the circumstances they want, and if they can't find them, make them." Well, it's pretty apparent, isn't it? And every person who discovered this for a while believed that he was the first one to work it out. We become what we think about. Now, it stands to reason that a person who's thinking about a concrete and worthwhile goal is going to reach it, because that's what he's thinking about. And we become what we think about. Conversely, the man who has no goal, who doesn't know where he's going, and whose thoughts must therefore be thoughts of confusion and anxiety and fear and worry, becomes what he thinks about. His life becomes one of frustration, fear, anxiety, and worry. And if he thinks about nothing, he becomes nothing. Now, how does it work? Why do we become what we think about? Well, I'll tell you how it works, as far as we know. Now, to do this, I want to tell you about a situation that parallels the human mind. Suppose a farmer has some land, and it's good, fertile land. Now, the land gives the farmer a choice. He may plant in that land whatever he chooses. The land doesn't care. It's up to the farmer to make the decision. Now, remember, we're comparing the human mind with the land, because the mind, like the land, doesn't care what you plant in it. It will return what you plant, but it doesn't care what you plant. Now, let's say that the farmer has two seeds in his hand. One is a seed of corn, the other is nightshade, a deadly poison. He digs two little holes in the earth and he plants both seeds, one corn, the other nightshade. He covers up the holes, waters, and takes care of the land, and what will happen? Invariably, the land will return what is planted. As it's written in the Bible, "As ye sow, so shall ye reap." Remember, the land doesn't care. It will return poison in just as wonderful abundance as it will corn. So up come the two plants, one corn, one poison. Now, the human mind is far more fertile, far more incredible and mysterious than the land, but it works the same way. It doesn't care what we plant. Success? Failure. A concrete worthwhile goal? Or confusion, misunderstanding, fear, anxiety, and so on. But what we plant, it will return to us. You see, the human mind is the last great unexplored continent on the earth. It contains riches beyond our wildest dreams. It will return anything we want to plant. Now you might say, well, if that's true, why don't people use their minds more? Well, I think they've figured out an answer to that, too. Our mind comes as standard equipment at birth. It's free. And things that are given to us for nothing, we place little value on. Things that we pay money for, we value. The paradox is that exactly the reverse is true. Everything that's really worthwhile in life came to us free. Our mind, our soul, our body, our hopes, our dreams, our ambitions, our intelligence, our love of family and children and friends. All these priceless possessions are free, but the things that cost us money are actually very cheap and can be replaced at any time. A good man can be completely wiped out and make another fortune. He can do that several times. Even if our home burns down, we can rebuild it, but the things we got for nothing, we can never replace. The human mind isn't used merely because we take it for granted. Familiarity breeds contempt. It can do any kind of job we assign to it, but generally speaking, we use it for little jobs instead of big, important ones. Universities have proved that most of us are operating on about 10% of our abilities. Decide now. What is it you want? Plant your goal in your mind. It's the most important decision you'll ever make in your entire life. Do you want to be an outstanding salesman, a better worker at your particular job? Do you want to go places in your company, in your community? All you've got to do is plant that seed in your mind. Care for it. Work steadily toward your goal, and it will become a reality. It not only will, there's no way that it cannot. You see, that is a law, like the laws of Sir Isaac Newton, the laws of gravity. If you get on top of a building and jump off, you'll always go down. You'll never go up. And it's the same with all the other laws of nature. They always work. They're inflexible. Think about your goal in a relaxed, positive way. Picture yourself in your mind's eye as having already achieved this goal. See yourself doing the things you will be doing when you've reached your goal. Ours has been called the phenobarbital age, the age of ulcers and nervous breakdowns. At a time when medical research has raised us to a new plateau of good health and longevity, far too many of us worry ourselves into an early grave trying to cope with things in our own little personal ways, without learning a few great laws that will take care of everything for us. These things we bring on ourselves through our habitual way of thinking. Every one of us is the sum total of his own thoughts. He is where he is because that is exactly where he really wants to be, whether he'll admit that or not. Each of us must live off the fruit of his thoughts in the future, because what you think today and tomorrow, next month and next year, will mold your life and determine your future. You're guided by your mind. I remember one time I was driving through Arizona and I saw one of those giant earth-moving machines roaring along the road at about 35 miles an hour with what looked like 20 tons of dirt in it, a tremendous, incredible machine, and there was a little man perched way up on top with the wheel in his hands guiding it. And as I drove along, I was struck by the similarity of that machine to the human mind. Just suppose you're sitting at the controls of such a vast source of energy. Are you going to sit back and fold your arms and let it run itself into a ditch? Or are you going to keep both hands firmly on the wheel and control and direct this power to a specific, worthwhile purpose? It's up to you. You're in the driver's seat. You see, the very law that gives us success is a two-edged sword. We must control our thinking. The same rule that can lead a man to a life of success, wealth, happiness, and all the things he's ever dreamed of for himself and his family, that very same law can lead him into the gutter. It's all in how he uses it, for good or for bad. This is the strangest secret in the world. Now, why do I say it's strange, and why do I call it a secret? Actually, it isn't a secret at all. It was first promulgated by some of the earliest wise men, and it appears again and again throughout the Bible. But very few people have learned it, understand it. That's why it's strange, and why, for some equally strange reason, it virtually remains a secret. I believe that you could go out and walk down the main street of your town and ask one man after another what the secret of success is, and you probably wouldn't run into one man in a month who could tell you. Now, this information is enormously valuable to us, if we really understand it and apply it. It's valuable to us not only for our own lives, but the lives of those around us, our family, employees, associates, and friends. Life should be an exciting adventure. It should never be a bore. A man should live fully, be alive. He should be glad to get out of bed in the morning. He should be doing a job he likes to do because he does it well. One time I heard Grove Patterson make a speech, the editor-in-chief of the Toledo Daily Blade. And as he concluded his speech, he said something that I've never forgotten. He said something like this. My years in the newspaper business have convinced me of several things. Among them, that people are basically good. And that we came from someplace, and we're going someplace. So we should make our time here an exciting adventure. The architect of the universe didn't build a stairway leading nowhere. And the greatest teacher of all, the carpenter from the plains of Galilee, gave us the secret time and time again. As ye believe, so shall it be done unto you. I've explained the strangest secret in the world and how it works. Now I want to explain how you can prove to yourself the enormous returns possible in your own life by putting this secret to a practical test. I want you to make a test that will last 30 days. Now, it isn't going to be easy. If you'll give it a good try, it will completely change your life for the better. Back in the 17th century, Sir Isaac Newton, the English mathematician and natural philosopher, gave us some natural laws of physics which apply as much to human beings as they do to the movement of bodies in the universe. Now, one of these laws is that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Simply stated, as it applies to you and me, it means we can achieve nothing without paying the price. The results of your 30-day experiment will be in direct proportion to the effort you put forth. To be a doctor, you must pay the price of long years of difficult study. To be successful in selling, and remember that each of us succeeds to the extent of his ability to sell, selling our families on our ideas, selling education in schools, selling our children on the advantages of living the good and honest life, selling our associates and employees on the importance of being exceptional people, to, of course, the profession of selling itself. But to be successful in selling our way to the good life, we must be willing to pay the price. Now, what is that price? Well, it's many things. First, it's understanding emotionally, as well as intellectually, that we literally become what we think about, that we must control our thoughts if we're to control our lives. It's understanding fully that, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. Secondly, it's cutting away all the fetters from the mind and permitting it to soar as it was divinely designed to do. It's the realization that your limitations are self-imposed and that the opportunities for you today are enormous beyond belief. It's rising above narrow-minded pettiness and prejudice. Thirdly, to use all your courage to force yourself to think positively on your own problem, to set a definite and clearly defined goal for yourself, to let your marvelous mind think about your goal from all possible angles, to let your imagination speculate freely upon many different possible solutions, to refuse to believe there are any circumstances sufficiently strong to defeat you in the accomplishment of your purpose, to act promptly and decisively when your course is clear, and to keep constantly aware of the fact that you are, at this moment, standing in the middle of your own acre of diamonds, as Russell Conwell used to point out. Fourth, save at least 10% of what you earn. It's also remembering that no matter what your present job, it has enormous possibilities if you're willing to pay the price. Now let's just go over the important points in the price each of us must pay to achieve the wonderful life that can be ours. It is, of course, worth any price. One, you will become what you think about. Two, remember the word imagination. Let your mind soar. Three, courage. Concentrate on your goal every day. Four, save 10% of what you earn. And action. Ideas are worthless unless we act on them. Now I'll try to outline the 30-day test I want you to make. Now keep in mind that you have nothing to lose by making this test and everything you could possibly want to gain. There are two things that may be said of everyone. Each of us wants something and each of us is afraid of something. I want you to write on a card what it is you want more than anything else. It may be more money. Perhaps you'd like to double your income or make a specific amount of money. It may be a beautiful home. It may be success at your job. It may be a particular position in life. It could be a more harmonious family. Each of us wants something. Write down on your card specifically what it is that you want. Make sure it's a single goal and clearly defined. You needn't show it to anyone, but carry it with you so that you can look at it several times a day. Think about it in a cheerful, relaxed, positive way each morning when you get up, and immediately you have something to work for, something to get out of bed for, something to live for. Look at it every chance you get during the day and just before going to bed at night. As you look at it, remember that you must become what you think about, and since you're thinking about your goal, you realize that soon it will be yours. In fact, it's yours really the moment you write it down and begin to think about it. Look at the abundance all around you as you go about your daily business. You have as much right to this abundance as any other living creature. It's yours for the asking. Now we come to the difficult part. Difficult because it means the formation of what is probably a brand new habit. And new habits are not easily formed. Once formed, however, it'll follow you for the rest of your life. Stop thinking about what it is you fear. Each time a fearful or negative thought comes into your consciousness, replace it with a mental picture of your positive and worthwhile goal. There will come times when you will feel like giving up. It's easier for a human being to think negatively than positively. That's why only 5% is successful. You must begin now to place yourself in that group. For 30 days, you must take control of your mind. It will think only about what you permit it to think. Each day for this 30-day test, do more than you have to do. In addition to maintaining a cheerful, positive outlook, give of yourself more than you've ever done before. Do this knowing that your returns in life must be in direct proportion to what you give. The moment you decide on a goal to work toward, you're immediately a successful person. You're then in that rare and successful category of people who know where they're going. Out of every 100 people, you belong to the top 5. Don't concern yourself too much with how you're going to achieve your goal. Leave that completely to a power greater than yourself. All you have to do is know where you're going. The answers will come to you of their own accord. Remember these words from the Sermon on the Mount, and remember them well. Keep them constantly before you this month of your test. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For everyone that asketh, receiveth, and he that seeketh, findeth, and to him that knocketh, it shall be opened. It's as marvelous and as simple as that. In fact, it's so simple that in our seemingly complicated world, it's difficult for an adult to understand that all he needs is a purpose and faith. For 30 days, do your best. If you're a salesman, go at it as you've never done before, not in hectic fashion, but with the calm, cheerful assurance that time well spent will give you the abundance in return you deserve and want. No matter what your job, do it as you've never done it before for 30 days. And if you've kept your goal before you every day, you'll wonder and marvel at this new life you've found. Dorothea Brand, outstanding editor and writer, discovered it for herself and tells about it in her fine book, Wake Up and Live. Her entire philosophy is reduced to the words, act as though it were impossible to fail. She made her own test with sincerity and faith, and her entire life was changed to one of overwhelming success. Now you make your test for 30 full days. Don't start your test until you've made up your mind to stick with it. You see, by being persistent, you're demonstrating faith. Persistence is simply another word for faith. If you didn't have faith, you would never persist. If you should fail during your first 30 days, by that I mean suddenly find yourself overwhelmed by negative thoughts, you've got to start over again from that point and go 30 more days. Gradually, your new habit will form until you find yourself one of that wonderful minority to whom virtually nothing is impossible. Don't forget the card. It's vitally important as you begin this new way of living. On one side of the card, write your goal, whatever it may be. On the other side, write the words we've quoted from the Sermon on the Mount. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. Nothing great was ever accomplished without inspiration. See that during these crucial first 30 days, your own inspiration is kept at a peak. Above all, don't worry. Worry brings fear, and fear is crippling. The only thing that can cause you to worry during your test is trying to do it all yourself. Know that all you have to do is hold your goal before you. Everything else will take care of itself. Remember also to keep calm and cheerful. Don't let petty things annoy you and get you off course. Now, since making this test is difficult, some may say, well, why should I bother? Well, look at the alternative. No one wants to be a failure. No one really wants to be a mediocre individual. No one wants a life constantly filled with worry, fear, and frustration. Therefore, remember that you must reap that which you sow. If you sow negative thoughts, your life will be filled with negative things. If you sow positive thoughts, your life will be cheerful, successful, and positive. Now, gradually, you will have a tendency to forget what you've heard on this record. Play it often. Keep reminding yourself of what you must do to form this new habit. Gather your whole family about and listen to what's been said here at regular intervals. You know, most men will tell you that they want to make money without understanding the law. The only people who make money work in the mint. The rest of us must earn money. This is what causes those who keep looking for something for nothing or a free ride to fail in life. The only way to earn money is by providing people with services or products which are needed and useful. We exchange our product or service for the other man's money. Therefore, the law is that our financial return will be in direct proportion to our service. Success is not the result of making money. Making money is the result of success, and success is in direct proportion to our service. Most people have this law backwards. They believe that you're successful if you earn a lot of money. The truth is that you can only earn money after you're successful. It's like the story of the man who sat in front of the stove and said to it, "Give me heat, and then I'll add the wood." How many men and women do you know, or do you suppose there are today, who take the same attitude toward life? There are millions. We've got to put the fuel in before we can expect heat. Likewise, we've got to be of service first before we can expect money. Don't concern yourself with the money. Be of service. Build. Work. Dream. Create. Do this, and you'll find there's no limit to the prosperity and abundance that will come to you. Prosperity is founded upon a law of mutual exchange. Any person who contributes to prosperity must prosper in turn himself. Sometimes the return will not come from those you serve, but it must come to you from someplace, for that is the law. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. As you go daily through your 30-day test period, remember that your success will always be measured by the quality and quantity of service you render, and money is a yardstick for measuring this service. No man can get rich himself unless he enriches others. There are no exceptions to a law. You can drive down any street in America and from your car estimate the service that's being rendered by the people living on that street. Had you ever thought of this yardstick before? It's interesting. Some, like ministers and priests and other devoted people, measure their returns in the realm of the spiritual, but again, their returns are equal to their service. Once this law is fully understood, any thinking person can tell his own fortune. If he wants more, he must be of more service to those from whom he receives his return. If he wants less, he has only to reduce this service. This is the price you must pay for what you want. If you believe you can enrich yourself by deluding others, you can only end by deluding yourself. It may take some time, but just as surely as you breathe, you'll get back what you put out. Don't ever make the mistake of thinking you can avert this. It's impossible. The prisons and the streets with a lonely walk are filled with people who tried to make new laws just for themselves. We may avoid the laws of man, but there are greater laws that cannot be broken. An outstanding medical doctor recently pointed out 6 steps that will help you realize success. 1, set yourself a definite goal. 2, quit running yourself down. 3, stop thinking of all the reasons why you cannot be successful, and instead, think of all the reasons why you can. 4, trace your attitudes back through your childhood and try to discover where you first got the idea you couldn't be a success, if that's the way you've been thinking. 5, change the image you have of yourself by writing out a description of the person you would like to be. And 6, act the part of the successful person you have decided to become. The doctor who wrote those words is a noted West Coast psychiatrist, David Harold Fink, M.D. Do what all experts since the dawn of recorded history have told you you must do. Pay the price by becoming the person you want to become. It's not nearly as difficult as living unsuccessfully. Make your 30-day test. Then repeat it. Then repeat it again. Each time it will become more a part of you until you'll wonder how you could ever have lived any other way. Live this new way, and the floodgates of abundance will open and pour over you more riches than you may have dreamed existed. Money? Yes, lots of it. But what's more important, you'll have peace. You'll be in that wonderful minority who lead calm, cheerful, successful lives. Start today. You have nothing to lose, but you have a life to win.
Hi everybody, I'm Jonathan Fields and this is Good Life Project. So my guest today is Josh Kaufman, and this is a special episode. One of the things that we've discovered through a lot of our viewers is that the process of trying to live a good life, a better life, often requires you learning a new set of skills. We've had a ton of questions over the last year from people who say, I would love to do this, but I don't have time in my life to do it. I don't want to wait forever to make it happen. So we're bringing you Josh, who's also the author of a book called The First 20 Hours, who's an expert in, I guess, what I would call accelerated learning. So great to be hanging out with you today.
Thanks for having me. Great to hang out.
Couldn't sort of like have asked for a better person to drop in at a better time, because it really is. It's an interesting thing. It seems like the world is moving faster.
Mm-hmm.
We all want to get stuff done. A lot of people want to make big changes and feel like they're living better lives, but they look out there and they're like, there's stuff that I need to know, stuff I need to learn, stuff I need to master to do it. And I just don't have time in the day to do
right,
it.
Right.
So I'm curious. I mean, I want to get like right in with you, sort of like the idea behind your book.
Sure.
But one quick question first, which is, what was the motivation for you to actually go down this rabbit hole?
Yeah. So 2 primary motivations. The first is, you know, in terms of the research and the writing that I do, I like to look at topics that are like fundamental human experiences, like things that everybody needs to know or everybody deals with in some way, shape, or form. And those things can be, you know, big and complex and scary and frustrating in a lot of ways. But if you just dive in and break it down, what you often find is it's not really as hard as it feels.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the motivation was, you know, learning is something, you know, learning new skills is a fundamental part of what it is to be human. Mm-hmm. And so let's figure out how to do that. Let's figure out how to do it better.
And most people, like, for most people, the thought of, I mean, for me, the thought of learning new stuff, I'm giddy. I love
yeah.
it. But for a lot of people,
it's terrifying.
Right.
Right. Particularly if it's something you know would be super fun or super valuable, but you know nothing about it, and you just look at
right.
it, it's like, oh my gosh, this is really big. The motivation for me personally was, I run my own business. My wife, Kelsey, runs her own business. And 2.5 years ago, our daughter, Leela, came into the world. And all of a sudden, we had zero.
Right.
Zero free time. And so, you know, I, just like you, I really geek out about this stuff. I have a list of things that I want to learn a mile long. And so, you know, not having any time, it's like, okay, I may only be able to set aside, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes a day.
Yes.
So if that's all I have, then, you know, let's figure out how to learn as quickly as possible in that short time.
And at the same time, you don't want to wait forever to get results. I mean,
that's,
a lot of people are like, okay, I could figure out, like, I could scrap somehow to find, like, that half an hour a day. But does doing it so little mean that it's going to take me, like, 10 years to actually be decent enough at it so it'll actually be fun?
Right. And what I found through my research is that totally not the case. It doesn't take very long.
Yeah.
Even if you know absolutely nothing, or you only have a certain amount of time every day to sit down and learn it, you can become very, very good at something in a very short period of time.
Mm.
I think that's fun.
So, but this flies in the face to a certain extent also in what like has commonly become known as the 10,000 hour rule.
Sure. A little bit. It's actually a lot more complimentary than it would seem at the surface. So the whole idea of the 10,000 hour rule came from research by K. Anders Ericsson, Florida State University. And the idea behind that was, you know, if you look at the people in ultra-competitive, easily ranked fields, professional golfers, musicians, all of these folks where you can get an estimate of who really is the best in the world in an objective level.
Right.
The question that Dr. Ericsson was researching is, what does it take to get to that level
on some very narrow thing?
Yeah. So yeah, if you want to step on a golf course and compete with Tiger Woods, that's about the amount of time it's going to take you to get there. But the vast majority of us, that's not the goal. That's not what we're trying to do.
Mm.
We just may have something in our minds that we want to accomplish, or an area of life we want to explore. And it takes a lot less time to get what we want out of it.
And I guess for a lot of people, the motivation is probably one of two things. You want to get good enough so you enjoy doing it.
Yeah.
Or maybe like professionally, you want to develop a skill set enough so that you can actually start to leverage it to
Absolutely.
Build your career or change your career for a lot of people.
Yeah. Like, so there are a bunch of things that you can learn that can help you do better in your business. There are a bunch of things that you can do to do for fun. It doesn't take that long.
Yeah. So let's dive right into it because you kind of have a methodology
that
you developed. So take us through it's five sort of like core ideas.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So the first step in this process, and this is something that applies to every skill. Could be a motor skill like, you know, learning how to fly an airplane or skateboard or something like that. Could be a cognitive skill like language or programming or something. So the first step is deciding exactly what it is you want, right? Why are you jazzed about this thing in the first place? If you're able to really clearly define what it is you're trying to get, it's called setting a target performance level. The more clearly that level of performance, or the more clearly you can define that, the easier it is for you to look out into the world and find ways to get there in the most direct way.
Okay.
Possible, right?
So, like, what's an example of that?
So, for example, for me, I learned a lot of things in the process of putting together this book. And one of the things that I wanted to be able to do was program. And so, instead of just saying I want to be a programmer, right? Doesn't give you any information whatsoever.
So amorphous.
It's here is this idea of a program that I would like to sit down and create from nothing, and it looks like A, B, C, D, E, F, G. When I make this thing, I'll have developed the skills that are necessary in order to get a particular result, right?
Got it.
So instead of learning everything in the world about programming, I decided this is the subsegment of that skill I'm interested in learning first, so that's what I'm going to focus on first.
So it has to be like very goal-oriented and also very specific.
Yes. So what is it going to look like when you're done? What are you going to be able to see or experience that'll let you know you reached the level?
Okay, so like if you want to learn a language, I want to speak French enough, or is it
not enough?
So, like,
yeah.
What would that look like in your sort of like framework?
So, let's say, for example, I want to go to a restaurant that has a French-speaking waiter, and I want to order and conduct the entire meal in this language, and have a good time doing it. That's something that's specific enough to practice.
Got it. Okay.
So you make it. Almost make it too specific at the beginning, because once you get to that level, you can always ratchet up the stakes, right? You reach that threshold, practice something else.
I mean, what I found is once you get the most baseline proficiency in something, it sucks less.
Yes.
And now you actually, like that baseline level it creates a whole new level of motivation to want to learn more, because now you've kind of gotten through like the scales in music or something like that.
Yeah, and it's important to understand that the first couple hours of practicing something new are frustrating.
Yeah.
For everyone. Everybody's terrible at the beginning. And so, you know, if you can push through those early few hours, the practice itself becomes fun and it becomes way easier to continue to improve.
So, okay, so that's number one.
Yep.
Number two.
Okay, so after you decide what you want, you do what's called deconstructing the skill. And the idea behind that is a lot of the things that we think of as skills, like, for example, playing golf or speaking French or learning how to program, those aren't exactly skills. They're really kind of general topics that contain lots of smaller sub-skills.
Right.
So it's really hard to practice being a good golfer. It's way easier to practice hitting off of the tee with a driver. Right? So
right.
you take the global skill and you break it up into much smaller parts. And if you're clear about what you want, it becomes very easy to find what are those sub-skills, what are the smaller parts that are actually going to help you get to that target performance level as quickly as possible.
So like if there are 100 sub-skills, if you've done number one, it makes it much easier to figure out, okay, what are the 15 of those sub-skills that are going to give me 80% of the results towards getting where I want to go.
And what you often find is it's only maybe two or three sub-skills that you use most of the time.
Huh.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, breaking it down into small enough chunks. If you do just a little bit of research, which is actually step three, right? You go out into the world and you find sources of information that help you do this deconstruction. If you look at, you know, say for example, pick up 5 books on whatever it is that you're trying to learn how to do. Don't read them cover to cover. Skim all of them, one right after the other.
Right.
And what you'll see is the two or three sub-skills that you're going to use most of the time are the ones that come up over and over again. Right? So you just practice those first. And if you spend your time practicing those things, and avoid a lot of the distractions or things that aren't going to help you, you save a lot of time and energy as you're practicing.
So that's a big question, so I'll ask you now. If out of a whole basket of potential sub-skills that add up to this thing that you want to accomplish, only a small handful are very often really, really critical, why are we taught to do them all at once?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for that, actually. I think the biggest thing is we treat, in our culture now, learning as a very academic exercise. Like the objective is to suck in a ton of information about this thing, whether or not you're going to use it. And I think, you know, education in our culture now has been seen in the academic sense and less in the sense of practicing something with the eye of using it to do some particular cool thing.
So it's less applied.
Yeah.
More
So, you know, the whole idea of researching the topic and something that I had to train myself out of is I love doing research, right? So the first thing, like programming was a good example of this for me. It's like, oh, I want to learn how to program. I get 10 books, I have these courses, I'm going to go through all of this stuff, and then I'm going to sit down and write a program. It's like, no. You use the research, do just enough research to help you do the deconstruction and find the most important sub-skills first, and then get out of research mode and into practice mode as quickly as you can.
Because that's where the real stuff's going to happen.
Yeah, and when you start practicing what it is you're actually trying to do, that's when you see the performance improvement.
Now, you also made a differentiation when we started the conversation between cognitive skills, like learning a language, and did you use motor skills?
Yep.
Motor skills, you know, like swinging a bat or, you know, playing golf. Do all of these steps, I mean, we still have two more to work through, but you know, with the three that we've covered so far, are they all sort of equally relevant to both types of learning?
Yeah, so for both types of learning, you have to go through the same general process. Some of the actual practice techniques can be different. So for example, one of the things that you can do when you're practicing a motor skill, which works really well, is practice it within a couple hours of going to sleep. Either taking a nap or going to bed for the night. And there's a lot of research around the idea of what's called consolidation. So your brain translates the practice and experience you had and encodes neural connections to help you do it better.
Right.
That practice or that process is way more efficient if you practice within about 4 hours of going to sleep. So I, in the process of writing the first 20 hours, I retaught myself how to touch type on a different keyboard, which was like, you know, having the experience of rewiring my brain to do something differently.
Right.
And then, you know, fun things like playing the ukulele, which is all motor skills. And it was surreal experience. I would practice it right before I would go to bed. And, you know, the first couple hours of practice was just terrible.
Right.
So I would practice, I'd go to bed, I'd pick it up first thing in the morning just to see. And it was like astounding how much better I was after a couple hours sleep.
That's amazing.
Because, you know, sleep helps consolidate that kind of
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, no, that's really cool.
So yeah, some of the actual practice techniques are different, but the same, the general process is the same.
Right. So that's pretty remarkable. You literally wake up in the morning and you're better than you were when you went to sleep just because you slept in the middle of it.
Absolutely. So yeah, so for
like noticeably better, like really?
Noticeably better. Like, you know, one of the, in the process of learning typing, like, you know, once I switched keyboard format, I went from typing about as fast as I could think to literally like 5 words per minute, like terrible.
Right.
And so, you know, practicing right before bed and getting up in the morning and trying to use my computer, like in the first couple of days I was doing it, it was like, oh my gosh, I can actually like type now. I can do something.
That's crazy.
And, yeah. So, you know, that type of thing works for a motor skill. For cognitive skills, memorization techniques like spaced repetition reinforcement, like flashcard model or flashcards with feedback helping you remember things works really well. So yeah, the actual practice techniques can be very different, but the core method of learning is very much the same.
And again, for both of them, before you go to bed?
Yes.
Helps with the consolidation.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. What about simulated practice?
Simulated practice can be effective as long as it is as close to real-world performance as you can make it.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of the, you know, trying to memorize something and then having that translate directly into practice doesn't really work.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking more in terms of like motor skills.
Okay.
Yeah, like when I was a gymnast, when I was a kid, we would, you know, before any event, you know, I would basically, before I would step up to a piece of apparatus, I would kind of close my eyes and I would actually envision my body, like moving through the entire thing.
Okay.
And then there was all this research that said that, you know, it triggers all the same motor neurons that would be triggered, like the same response in your brain.
Yes.
As if you were actually doing it, but I'm curious in terms of sort of like, you know, accelerated learning, whether that would actually make you progress faster and towards a high level of proficiency in that skill.
There is quite a bit of research that says that imaginary types of practice does work, and it works well, with a catch, which is you have to do it in addition to
the
physical practice.
Right.
So if you're starting to consolidate those motor movements and you're doing that in practice, and then you're reinforcing that with imagined practice, awesome.
Got it.
But you know what I found is a lot of people get caught up in the process of just doing the physical practice first.
So we got to 3 of the 5 steps now. Mm-hmm. So let's kind of like close the loop here. So step number 4.
Okay. Step number 4 is removing barriers to practice. So things that are preventing you from actually sitting down and doing the work.
Okay.
Sometimes those things are environmental distractions, like, you know, turning off the TV or blocking the internet or closing the door, you know, all of the things that you can do to make sure in those early hours of practice, which are frustrating, you don't get so frustrated that it's easy to stop focusing on whatever it is that you're doing and start paying attention to something else. You know, likewise, anything that you can do to make sure it takes as little energy as possible to start practicing is super helpful at that point. So, you know, instead of keeping your guitar in the case in the back of the closet on the other side of your house,
right?
Take the guitar out of the case, get a stand, put it right next to your next to your couch. And that just, you know, anything that you can do to make it easier on yourself to get those early hours of practice, the better.
Yeah, I mean, my guitar is actually hanging out on a rack because of that. It's like almost because I just forget it's even there.
Totally.
You know, it's like the visual cue actually makes a really big difference for me. Yeah. All right, so number 4 is now. I'm curious also, I mean, it sounds like there's a bit of crossover between that and sort of like B.J. Fogg's work on really
tiny habits.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, a lot of the same, you know, this is where the behavioral psychology elements of this come in.
Right.
It's how can you make it easier to do the thing that you want to be doing instead of getting distracted by some shiny object and going and doing something else. So instead of relying on exerting a lot of willpower to force yourself to do this thing that you've decided you want to do, you spend a little bit of willpower, a little bit of time and energy, altering the structure of the environment around you. Right. And just make it easy as possible to do the thing that you want to
do.
Yeah,
totally makes sense.
Yeah.
All right, last item, number
last
five.
Last one. Pre-commit to practicing at least 20 hours. And this is the big one. So all the things that we've talked about so far is getting set up to sit down and do the work of actually practicing. The pre-commitment and the idea of practicing at least 20 hours, there's a lot of behavioral psychology behind that. The two big things is, first, it's a really important check on your reasons for learning this thing in the first place.
So it's kind of like, if I'm not willing to commit to 20 hours, I can't be all that serious about it.
Yeah, it's like, is it worthwhile for me to rearrange my schedule and stop doing other things? And, you know, is this something that I'm expecting to get enough benefit from to make the effort worth it?
Yeah.
If it's not, don't do it.
Right.
Life is short, you know? It's like, go do something else that you will get more benefit out of or you are more excited about. So if you're willing to set aside at least 20 hours, what the pre-commitment does is make sure that you practice long enough to push through that early frustration and actually start seeing results. And I think a lot of us really seriously overestimate just how long it takes to become good at something. Mm. So you can become really, really good at something, surprisingly good at something, in as little as 20 hours.
Mm.
So if you practice that long, you're going to be way better at the end of that than you were at the beginning.
Yeah. I guess a lot of people also figure, well, you know, 20 hours, you know, I've done that with a million different things and, you know, I really wasn't very good. But probably when they actually look back and say, well, no, like I missed 3 days here and like that one day where I, you know, said I was practicing for an hour, I was really only practicing for 10 minutes. So when you really add up all the time, I'm guessing there's a little bit of self-delusion that happens.
There's actually quite a bit of research behind this. Our minds are not built to accurately estimate time. And in the early parts of learning something new, it's like, you know, it's terrible. It's like, oh man, I've been at this hours. And you look at the clock and you've been at it 10 minutes.
Right.
And so a lot of the, you know, both pre-committing to a certain amount of practicing. So 20 hours roughly is about 40 minutes a day per month, give or take.
So you kind of think in your mind 40 minutes a day for a month.
So a couple of, and I usually break my practice sessions into about 20 minutes apiece, right? So 2 20-minute practice sessions every day for about a month can get you there. And so, you know, if you're able and willing to do that, pre-committing the time, make sure that you practice long enough to see that really good result. But it's also, you know, psychologically, it doesn't feel like that big of a hurdle to say, okay, this is important to me.
Right.
I can set aside at least that amount of time, right? So it's just enough that you're going to see dramatic results, but not so much that it prevents you from making the pre-commitment in the first place.
I love that. So let's recap the five steps.
Okay. So the five steps in order. Step one, decide what you want. What's your target performance level?
Mm.
Step two is deconstruct the skill. Separate it into smaller sub-skills. Practice the most important ones first. Number three is research the skill just enough to do the deconstruction and choose the most important sub-skills, but not so much that it becomes a barrier to practice in itself. Number four is eliminate barriers to practice. Make it easy to do what you want to do. And number five is pre-commit to practicing whatever it is that you want to be able to do for at least 20 hours.
Mm. Love it. All right. So my mind is spinning because I'm thinking to myself, okay, what am I going to do?
I was going to ask, what's in the back of your mind? Have you always wanted to learn how to do?
It's interesting. I mean, languages, because I don't speak another language.
Mm-hmm.
I took Latin for 6 years, which means I speak nothing but English. It's interesting. Like, I want to blurt out a whole bunch of different things, but number five is making me say, I need to really think about this.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to, like, say, okay, people, I'm going to commit to this publicly.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, an hour after we film this, I'm like, I'm not really, like, willing to put in my 20 hours for that. So it's interesting. I'm really thinking that through. Awesome conversation. And I love sort of, like, the breakdown that you have. And this is all part of, obviously...
Yeah.
Detailed and, you know, a whole bunch more extensively in the first 20 hours. But thanks for stopping by and sharing this with me, because like I said, one of the consistent questions that we keep getting from people is, you know, I know that for me to get to a place where I feel like, you know, like I'm living well in the world, I'm doing these things, career, personal, whatever it is, there's a body of knowledge that I need to know and get decent at. But I don't know how to do it, and I think it's going to take forever. So I think this is a really great formula to help people get there.
Thanks. And, you know, I think the really good news is that the outcome of this research is the barrier to sitting down and learning something new is not intellectual. Mm. We're all smart enough to sit down and figure it out and practice in a
right.
smart way. The barrier is emotional. And so, you know, a lot of these things are just working with ourselves in a smart way to decide we're interested in doing something, figure out how to do it, and actually sit down and
nice.
Practice so we can do a bunch of cool stuff.
Love it.
That's fun.
Awesome.
All right.
Fantastic.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. My guest today has been Josh Kaufman, the author of The First 20 Hours. I'm Jonathan Fields, signing off for good. We'll be right back.
say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass, high as hell and everything. And there's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars it is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back at the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pulled up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. Wow. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family gonna live in there? Is they gonna, I'm gonna get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
All right, today's podcast has been titled 20 Hours. And Doubt is a Thief. Originally it was just called Doubt is a Thief, which basically, I mean, if you doubt something that's not going to happen, doubt interferes with it. So eliminate doubt as best you can, so if, particularly if you're dealing with a challenging situation. Now, if you're dealing with a challenging situation, that's why we brought up 20 hours, because I'm looking at, you know what, life is really a series of math problems. So we have an event on November the 4th here in Florida, and we had to, on that day, we don't have 20 hours to build what we need to build, so we had to figure out within 20 hours before November the 4th on how we can build a tiny house within an hour. That's a math problem. I mean, the nine friends thing, it was a math problem. You know, some people can take that same house and take a weekend or a whole week or even a whole month to renovate a house. But they renovated a house in a matter of, let's say, let's see, the guy went to work, so he worked 8 hours. Let's say within 7-8 hours. Well, it was complete when he got back, so let's say they did it within 6 hours. So, all right, nine pickup trucks. Let's say 2 people per pickup truck. That's 36 hands. Well, 38, including the guy who called the nine friends. So 38 hands were able to take a house that had been boarded up and vacant for years, made it look brand new on the inside and out within, let's say, between 6 to 8 hours. So we have to figure out, we've got about, maybe we'll probably have about five to seven people. That's 10 to 14 hands. And we have 1 hour to build a tiny house. That's a mad problem. That's a mad problem I'm working on right now. So, but we'll share it to you. You know, on November the 4th, you'll see how that mad problem turns out. But I got to figure it out like now. So, I can assign parts and that type thing. Okay, that's all I got for you for today. Let's see. Now, I wrote in the program notes, breaking down 20 hours. Now, in other words, you can do, trying to figure out everything within one day, 24 hours. You know, you can spend 5 days, you know, working at what you need to learn. You spend 4 hours a day over 5 days, you got 20 hours in. And that's active learning, okay? Or you can do, if you want to do it in less time, you can spend 8 hours a day active learning. And in 3 days, you would have gotten your 20 hours in. That would have been 24 hours. And then yesterday, I sure got interrupted. Oh, Blog Talk had maintenance issues. Money. If you need money, get a customer. So we're going to do that show in its entirety, if not. What's today? Wednesday. We don't do it this week. See if we can do it between tomorrow or Friday, maybe. If not Friday, next week. Anyway, Robin, are you there?
Yes, I have a question.
Okay.
So,
I might have an answer. I don't know.
So it's nine friends. That's 18 hands.
No. Now, here's how I did the arithmetic. All right, nine friends. The audio said he called his friends. Now, nine pickup trucks showed up. So I'm figuring in each pickup truck there were two people, the driver, and the driver had an additional person in that pickup truck. So nine pickup trucks times two people per pickup truck is 18 people. 18 people times two hands each is 36 hands. Plus the guy
who
called the nine friends, that's 38.
Okay. And then another question, why does it have to be an hour?
Doesn't have to be an hour, but we're that's the reason why I'm putting it down to an hour, because I've been studying manufacturing of some of the manufacturing giants and little people. Toyota manufacturers, they make 29.9 cars per minute. So I figure,
yeah,
you know, the goal, it's a goal. Now, we might not get down to an hour for one place, but it's a math problem. Like, see, everything... The way I'm looking at things now is a series of math problems. You know, it's just, okay, how can I do this in order to reach this goal? That's what algebra is all about anyway. And basically, you can solve a lot of problems by basic first to third grade arithmetic, which is a problem can be solved. Many problems can be solved, particularly when it comes to personal business finance, through this basic arithmetic, subtraction, multiplication, or division.
Okay. Very good. Okay.
So you can throw in geometry. So anyway, like I say, that's a goal, you know. But anyway, that's how I came up with the 38 hands, because I figured, in a pickup truck. And I'm not even including, they could have had more if they had people riding in the open part of a pickup truck, the pickup part of the pickup truck, you know, where you put your whatever you groceries or wood or lumber or whatever. Some people could have been lit riding in the back of that, but I was concerned. I said, you know what, let's just say it's a driver in each pickup truck and at least one person sitting in the cab with the driver. So I said, as an average, let's just say two per vehicle. We know 9 pickup trucks showed up. We know that much. And I'm looking at, to make it look brand new inside and out, you just couldn't have did that with 9 people. So, and then some people, they were there, they were probably not working in the capacity of painting, cleaning up, or anything like that. I'm figuring he had a kitchen crew, he had a gopher crew. So let's say out of the 18 people, you got to figure about four to eight of them were not doing anything dealing with hammering, nailing, drilling, and nothing like that. They were runners, preparing food, stuff like that.
They were all hands on deck. I guarantee it. I guarantee it. They were all hands on deck. Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you call on deck? I don't think all of them were doing the hammering and nailing.
Just like on a ship, the crew.
Yeah, everybody's got their they got an assignment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with
and
you.
So,
they were all hands
so,
on deck with their assignment.
I don't think that they were doing, I don't think anybody was doing not building tasks is what I'm saying. That's what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
They were all doing building tasks because, number one, they were already meeting after work. So they would have already eaten. Or so they don't have to have somebody to supply meals or whatever. And then the cleanup, they're gonna have to drop things and stuff like that, and that's gonna be done after they get done on their task. You understand? So nobody's gonna be sitting there sweeping, mopping, standing there waiting for everybody to do whatever. All hands are gonna be busy. Somebody, they're going to be sawing, chopping, slicing, dicing, whatever. That's what I think.
That's the beauty of stuff like this. It's sort of like, how to prepare a Thanksgiving dinner. There's no one set way to do it.
Yeah.
So it's only limited to your imagination on how you're going to organize what you have to work with. So there's no wrong answer. There's an infinite amount of ways in which you can get stuff done. So like I said, the way I'm looking at it, based on the crews I've been a part of organized, you got people that they're in charge of the grub. You got runners in case, if they had to run out of materials or whatever, they go to wherever and get it and come back. So I'm just basing it on that. That's how I'm looking at it. But it's no right or wrong way.
Yeah.
To do
well,
it.
Well, if
so.
They were doing it overnight, they were all hands on deck. They weren't runners. I mean, because ain't nothing open for nobody to go get something.
Well, it all depends on what neck of the woods that they're living in. Like where I'm at, well, put it this way. Let me go to D.C. in D.C., if you want to go grocery shopping, you can go to Giant, 2, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning. You can go shopping.
Yeah.
And some places, you can go to Walmart 24 hours. So it all depends on what neck of the woods that you're in. Then when I've gone to like two tiny house retreats, and the first one I went to, there was about 50 people, and there were probably about four different tiny house projects that people can pick and choose. So you had people in different phases. Now, everybody wasn't all hands on deck, but, you know, stuff was getting done. So, you know, it's you know, you got to work with what you got.
Yeah.
I know. Now, I've had a whole house painted, which was, it was in Pittsburgh, a townhouse. It was, I didn't have them go in the basement, so we took, it was two floors, living room, dining room, kitchen on the first floor, and on the top floor, three bedrooms and a bathroom. So we had, I had about 7 or 8 people, and we painted, I got them all from the Salvation Army, which is right around the corner from where they were, but I still have to pick them. We had that whole house painted, and I'd say 3 hours max.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
So, which saved me money. Now, I could have did it solo, but no, I said no, because I had to drive 5 hours to get there. No, I had to drive. How long did I drive? That drive was between 4 to 5 hours. I don't know. I drove that so many times. So I wanted to get up there, do what I need to do, and then get out and get back home. So that's why I got that many people to paint in a couple hours. But any event, now with our event on November the 4th, we've got probably 7 RSVPs. All right. So far, besides me, there's one male RSVP, and there might be another one coming out of Texas. So you'll just have 3 males. The rest are females. So I'm working out on how to make this female friendly. So anyway, but we'll pick up on that tomorrow. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day. And Blog Talk is not cooperating. Let me see here. Doggone it. All right, let's try this.
Call me Louis. This is my spot.